بحالي انت جوها وانتيني ونسيتك بعد ولعت ونسيتيني يا بحالي انت جوها وانتيني ونسيتك بعد ولعت ونسيتيني بحالي انت جوها وانتيني.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by Richard Downey, who is a Deputy Director and Fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies Africa Program. Previously, he was a reporter and BBC journalist and worked in projects on Africa for the Council on Foreign Relations and the United States Institute of Peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Downey.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
What do you make of the rather predictable rejection by the Libyan rebels of the African Union's proposals of a truce? Clearly, there's a visual contrast on television where you see the African Union delegates hugging Gaddafi, kisses all around, and down in Benghazi, the rebel stronghold, thousands of people outside are booing and hissing at them.
Right, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It was predictable that the rebels would reject this peace overture. Really, it was a non-starter, I think. The rebels, after all, have one key demand, which is a prerequisite for any other negotiations, and of course that's the departure of Gaddafi and his family members. So given that that was not part of the deal that the AU were trying to sell, it's therefore not surprising that they turned it down. And you're right to draw that contrast between the receptions that these AU representatives had in Tripoli and then out in the east. I think the rebels were very suspicious and wary of this proposal and thought that these guys were too close to Gaddafi.
So why did Jacob Zuma lead this delegation there in the first place?
Well, apparently he had other business to attend to, but it's interesting that upon departure he described the mission as a great success. Well, I think the AU actually is... has been made to look a little bit naive in this whole episode. You know, first that they would take seriously anything that Gaddafi says. After all, you have to remember that he immediately agreed to their terms of peace, but then carried on bombing civilians in Misrata. Second, you know, the AU, if they honestly thought the rebels would accept a deal that didn't include Gaddafi's departure, then that was pretty naive as well, I think.
Well, I mean, the organization itself, which of course was formed in 1999 during an African summit hosted by Colonel Gaddafi, and of course he has been one of its biggest financial contributors from the outset. It is now, the current AU president is Equatorial Guinea's dictator, Teodoro Obiang, who we here in Los Angeles are graced with the presence of his son, who lives in the biggest mansion in Malibu, where he is has all kinds of Ferraris lined up and young women visiting around the clock. So how can we take this organization seriously, given that this rather psychotic kleptocrat is head of the AU?
You're right. It's not a great image to portray, is it, when you're an organization that is supposed to be standing up for good governance and democracy and the rights of not only African leaders, but African citizens in general, when it's led this year by one of the continent's just most unreformed dictators. I mean, someone like Obiang has no concept whatsoever of democracy, sees it as a completely foreign concept. So, the imaging is kind of jarring. That's right. But I do think on the plus side, the AU is trying to move in the right direction. It succeeded the Organization of African Unity, which was widely regarded as sort of dictator's club. At least the AU tries to launch peace missions such as the ones you've seen in Libya, also in Cote d'Ivoire to end the election crisis there. They talk of good governance. In fact, they have actually suspended African members who have fallen to military coups, such as Cote d'Ivoire and Mauritania not too long ago. So they are sort of making moves in the right direction, but it's slow progress. And as you say, there's still many hurdles to overcome.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Downey, Deputy Director of the Center for Strategic and International Studies Africa Program. Of course, Cote d'Ivoire has undergone the agony there was ended by the snatching of the intransigent leader who lost the election, which was apparently very fairly conducted. The AU didn't, because it was mostly the regional group, ECOWAS, that tried to reason with Gbagbo and get him to leave. And, of course, we've witnessed a fairly hideous bloodletting in order to bring about some kind of truce. But it seems to me that in that case, there's been atrocities on both sides. How do you come down on that one, Richard?
Yeah, I think you're right. There have been atrocities committed by both sides in this conflict. The bulk of them clearly by Gbagbo, who, as you say, lost a free and fair election, lost it quite clearly. So I think in the end, it looks like we've turned the corner, and with Gbagbo's arrest, hopefully Ivory Coast, Cote d'Ivoire can put these troubles behind them. Actually, in terms of the international response on this crisis, I would give the AU and the wider international community higher marks in at least that they were dedicated and committed to seeking a resolution right from the outset. They were quite unified. And eventually that pressure, albeit military in the end, has paid off. And so, you know, I'm optimistic now that the country can move on and at least recover economically. But overcoming the political divisions that have fragmented the country for so long now will be a much more tricky prospect.
In a broader sense, where does the debate stand within Africa itself about its democratic future, given what's happening now with the so-called Arab Spring? There are seems to be two schools of thought, that those who say, well, development first and then democracy will follow, and those that say, no, without democracy you'll never have development, you'll have what you have in so many cases, these kleptocratic thugs who hold on to power through the barrel of the gun.
Yeah, I think the debate is yet to be settled in Africa. We had a sort of a democratization process which looked pretty good about 10 years ago in the sort of late mid to late 90s and perhaps early 2000s. Well, things have plateaued a little bit more recently, and you're having this worrying trend in recent years where losing candidates such as Laurent Gbagbo in Ivory Coast turn around and reject the outcome of elections. And I think this is actually a bad thing for the democratic process and legitimacy of elections in Africa. Of course, many of these losing candidates, Gbagbo aside, had good reason to claim that they were falsely denied victory. But, you know, each time this happens, and you've seen it in several elections this year alone, it kind of degrades the process and causes the electorate themselves to lose faith in democracy. So I think that's one of the big issues right now. And we've got some very critical elections going on in Nigeria right now and other countries later this year. So I think it's very important that we keep an eye on these elections and hope that they go more smoothly.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Downey, Deputy Director of the Center for Strategic and International Studies Africa Program. Let's just return to Libya, if we can, here, because this peace deal was a phony to begin with, and its rejection was predictable. However, there is apparently a stalemate, and you have this kind of Mad Max army on the part of the rebels that is clearly not coordinated with NATO. And NATO itself, having lost the United States, appears to be floundering. So do you see this heading towards a very unsatisfactory stalemate and possibly a division of this country?
Well, I think we are in a situation of stalemate, at least militarily, on the ground right now. And it's hard to see a way out of this impasse at the moment. And so, therefore, I think you are going to see more peace initiatives going forward now. Although the AU one wasn't very successful, there's going to be more to come. And I think that both warring sides are going to have to become a little bit more flexible because at the moment their demands just cannot be bridged. On the battlefield, the rebels, you're right, there's just no sign that they're going to be able to force the issue militarily anytime soon. They're still disorganized. They're desperate for training and equipment and weapons. Even if they do receive training, it's going to take several months for the effect to kick in and for them to make advances. Gaddafi, meanwhile, I think feels fairly secure. He's playing the international community at their own game, and he seems on top at the moment, I think. His military capability is obviously being degraded by this NATO campaign, but the NATO campaign is fairly limited in scope. So at the moment, I can't see the rebels capitalizing.
And what do you make of Musa Kusa's defection, if that's what it was, the foreign minister, former intelligence chief? He's gone to London, now he's gone to Qatar. Qatar, of course, is the only Arab country yet to join in with NATO. What do you think's going on there?
It's been an interesting few days, and there's been much debate about the significance of Musa Kusa's defection. Formerly very, very close to Gaddafi, was his intelligence chief at large for many, many years. Really, the sort of the man that was at his side, but was sidelined somewhat in the latter couple of years. So I think Gaddafi is sort of shrugging this defection off. The key people now are his current military and intelligence chiefs, and of course his immediate family members. So as long as they're loyal and around him, I think Gaddafi will feel fairly secure and won't be losing much sleep about Musa Kusa's disappearance.
And to the uncomfortable subject of racism in Africa, I was surprised. I host the UCLA Hammer Forum here in Los Angeles and did a forum recently on Sudan with representatives from the North and the South and a UCLA anthropologist who spent 50 years studying the country, which is, as you know, is splitting in two. And there's history of genocide and likely to be more genocidal activities. And what came out of that conference was this notion that much of the struggle is driven by racism, by the Arab North's racist attitude to the African South. And how much is racism a part of what's going on in Libya? Because Gaddafi has made an arrangement, or one of his sons, with the military in Chad. We heard earlier from the beginning of the military struggle, when the rebels were riding high and then were driven back largely by African mercenaries, it was alleged. So give us a sense of what's going on there in terms of, or as an Africanist, have you detected this Arab versus African racism?
Yeah, the Arab versus African dynamic is at play across this region. You're right. It was a key dynamic in the civil war between North and South Sudan. And it's an element, I think, in this conflict as well, and particularly around the debate about these foreign mercenaries who the rebels are accusing of kind of propping up Gaddafi and keeping him in power. I think they're too quick, the rebels, to blame foreigners, and by foreigners they mean sort of black Africans, sub-Saharan Africans. These are the mercenaries, they say, who are committing the most egregious human rights abuses on behalf of the Gaddafi regime. And it's very hard to kind of judge and gauge what's going on and how significant they are in numbers. I think there's a sense that as the conflict unfolds, it becomes easy to blame foreigners or Africans for all the problems of the country. And I don't think that's actually an accurate depiction of what's going on. It's clear that Gaddafi has more important sources of support than foreign mercenaries, not least among tribal followers and elements of his own military forces, which I think are much more important in deciding this crisis.
Well, apparently there's some Gaddafi's son, not Hamis, the other one, has apparently hired Belarusian special forces.
Right, exactly. The reports of mercenaries aren't just African mercenaries we're talking about. We've had all kinds of countries sort of thrown into the mix, Syria, Serbia, Ukraine, and Belarus, as you say. It's kind of hard to back up some of these reports, but it's clear that Gaddafi is very resourceful. He still has deep pockets despite the current crisis, and is able to attract mercenaries from many countries beyond the African continent.
So just returning for a moment, if we can, Richard Downey, to this division in Africa between those who advocate development first and democracy will follow and democracy first. What role is China playing in that? Because they're not great champions of democracy, as you know, but they're also active in development in Africa.
Right. Yeah, the influence of China is felt very, very strongly across the African continent. And of course, many African leaders, many of the less democratic ones, much prefer dealing with China. They don't receive lectures on human rights. China has a strictly business approach. And African leaders like dealing with them. Chinese workers and the Chinese governments provide them with the kinds of things they need, infrastructure, you know, roads and schools, the old presidential palace as well. So the Chinese involvement is a good thing for in the minds of many many African leaders. But you're right, this does play into this debate about what does Africa need most of all, development or democracy. And I just think that's a false distinction, even though it's claimed by African leaders. You have Paul Kagame in Rwanda, for example, who has touted the economic success of the country and its ability to reconstruct after the genocide of 94, and using that as an excuse to sort of tamp down dissent and really block any kind of political opposition from emerging. I just think that's a short-term and short-sighted strategy. People, of course, want to put food on the table and they want schools to go to, but ultimately that's not going to be enough if they don't have political freedoms as well.
How do you explain this anomaly of Zimbabwe, where you have neither democracy nor development?
Well, I think the story of democracy is in Zimbabwe. You know, it's a story of one ruthless dictator who's determined to just cling on to power for himself and his cronies and enrich himself. Mugabe has always been a dictator. He's never been committed to democracy. And he doesn't really mind what he does to keep in power. And if that includes impoverishing his people, then so be it. And unfortunately, Africa has a few of these types of characters, and I hope we see the back of them soon.
Well, just in closing, in the last minute then, Richard Downey, in terms of democracy, what's your takeaway from the Nigerian election?
Well, it remains to be seen at the moment. It's early days. We've just had the first weekend where we had the National Assembly elections. And so far, we can be cautiously optimistic, I think. They seem to be fairly credible. Not many reported instances of violence and voter intimidation. The opposition party seems to have made fairly strong gains. So far, so good, according to the international monitors and local monitors, for that matter. The crux, though, will be this coming weekend when we have the main event, the presidential election. So all eyes will be on what happens this weekend, and we just hope that Nigeria can pull off a better election than it had back in 2007.
Well, thank you for talking with us today, Richard Downey.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Downey, who's a Deputy Director and Fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies Africa program. Previously, he worked for the BBC as a journalist in Africa and worked on African projects with the Council on Foreign Relations and the United States Institute of Peace. We're going to take a brief station break now and be back talking about the connections between African dictators like the deposed Gbagbo and Christian Wright in Washington on C Street.
Kini mafisore re, Gbagbo. Kini mafisore re, Gbagbo.